Okay, I think we'll get started.
Let me adjust the lights. Okay, welcome everybody to the second week of class. We'll go through some administrative stuff, and then we have an exciting program today. So first of all, again, any questions on last week's work? Any questions that are regarding assistive technology that you might have that I can answer at this time? But there's a lot to absorb, so we'll... Anytime you have a question, let me know. I think I've already talked to all the students who missed the first lecture last Tuesday. And for people who are working on projects, it's the course policy to attend all the lectures. And if you happen to miss a lecture, the audio from the lecture can be reviewed. And the student is required to write a one-page summary, and which includes their thoughts, and submit that. The audio as well as the PowerPoint slides are online typically the morning after the class, so it'll be good. And anybody who knows that they're going to miss a class, it's good to tell me beforehand, so it's not a surprise to me. There's a couple students who were here last week that haven't yet enrolled on Access, and if that's the case for you, please enroll. It's easy to do. And there were some people who wanted to enroll in the lecture-only option but get a grade. And if there's anybody in that category that would really like to get a letter grade instead of a credit, no credit, please see me. There may be a way to get you a letter grade for the class.
Okay. We have a handout today. And there were two handouts last Tuesday. If anybody is missing those handouts from last week, please see me. I have extra copies up here. So the handout is a one-page handout, which includes some discussion items. So be prepared to discuss this at future lectures. There's a number of items that we're going to use to sort of get to the crux of disability, and also there are some other questions. And this is just involves mental exercises: how well you analyze things, how well you can communicate your thoughts, so we can have a discussion. So we'll do that every class session before we get into the lecture. I mentioned a couple times about communication skills, and I sort of want to elaborate them a little bit more. As I mentioned, communication skills include all sorts of things. writing reports and writing proposals for funding. And the funding might include your salary, and also review of other people's proposals and other people's papers. It also includes all types of oral presentations, which could be poster sessions, you know, both when you're a student and later on in your professional life, and also doing, you know, PowerPoint presentations. And you need good communication skills when you're brainstorming, and we'll do a little bit more about that on Thursday. And in general, when having professional discussions, you need to have good communication skills. So here are some situations where good communication skills would be beneficial. I mentioned this: you want to show other people how smart you are. When your course requires you to take part in discussions, present your team's projects, or write project reports, like this one. When you're trying to convince the professor that you deserve a good grade in class. When you are interviewing for your first job or competing for a raise, when you are teaching a course or presenting your research, when you're appearing on 60 Minutes.
How many people have been on 60 Minutes besides me?
Okay, so I know about that. When you're giving your Nobel Prize acceptance speech, when you're participating in the presidential debate, when you're leading a cabinet meeting,
when you're giving the State of the Union address.
And the point of all this is, you know, these are things that are metaphors because you don't know where you're going to be in life in your professional career. But having good communication skills will serve you well in any capacity.
So I want to encourage you to start using your communication skills.
I know everybody was told when they were a kid, don't talk in class. Well, that's all revoked now.
You're welcome to talk in class. And I want to hear what you're thinking.
And I want to get some discussion going on this. As I said, when I was in school, I didn't think communication skills were going to be important because I was going to be an engineer. And nobody told me those skills were going to be important. No, I thought I'd just do engineering stuff and that's it, you know.
And so I don't know what I was thinking back then. I think my plan was I was going to get by on my good looks. But, you know, you can't always count on that.
This is the cover of the current issue of National Geographic. And this has a bionic hand on it. And actually, a colleague of mine, Doug Schwant, was responsible for a part of the design. And he's not mentioned in here. But the purpose of I have this up here is to say that assistive technology like this is not something that's backwater. It's mainstream. It's out there. People are working out there on this. There's lots of research going on. There's lots of needs. So this is mainstream technology and concern. So, you know, keep that in mind. And what I'm also going to do to show you how much that this is in the news and is send students a couple tidbits. Like, for example, I have the URLs of this article, which is online, that I can send you. And it'd be
good for you to read that and just look at some of the other things.
So let's look at some familiar faces of people with disabilities. And we all know that Albert Einstein and Annette Funicello
has special meaning for me because this is the first time, the first person, first girl I thought of differently, you know, when I was growing up. I think you know what I mean.
So that's sort of important. So, you know, some of these people were disabled from birth or from an early age, but, you know, other people people became disabled after they gained some fame and continued to, you know, do well in society. Even, you know, we had a president that had a disability. So it's you know, it's people in every part of our society have disabilities, and they've all added to our diversity and our enjoyment and our entertainment and our knowledge. Some of these people, John Callahan, he's an artist that has cartoons that depict people with disabilities. So this is an example of making fun of his own group. And I'll show you one of those, his cartoons, next time. Josh Blue is a comedian who won the last Comic Standing competition. So, you know, he really excels in being funny. And some other people from all walks of life and different ages. And, you know, how cruel it must have been for Beethoven to, you know, lose his hearing when he was so much into music and stuff.
And to pose an easy question for you,
to get some response.
Well, what is the other name of the disease that Lou Gehrig has?
Okay, all right. all sorts of other people who have continued to be in the public eye,
and have actually worked on foundations and worked toward research and advocacy for people in, with disabilities.
And this is actually a skin disease that Michael Jackson said he had that caused his skin to become lighter. So whether or not that's a disability is another issue. But
This is a rare picture of Moses. You know, this is really hard to get.
Very rare. But
how many people knew that Moses had a speech impediment?
Yeah, right. So it goes way back to biblical times. And all sorts of other people. Stephen Hawking,
you know, he's considered the smartest guy in the world, and is very severely disabled, and but he's able to communicate his thoughts
and stuff. So that's good. And what has given him the ability to communicate is
assistive technology. Without that, he would just be sitting in a wheelchair.
And some other people, more local people that you might know of, have disabilities, impairments. So assistive technology really helps, you know, people with disabilities
function to the best that they
to pursue their own skills and talents and professional life and excel in that. Last year we had T.V. Rahman here. He's a local researcher at Google. Peter Axelson we'll see later on in the course. He'll be flying in from Nevada in his own adaptive plane. And we'll also see Ralph Hotchkiss from Berkeley. So basically assistive technology is really instrumental in helping a person
use the talents and knowledge and skills that they have.
Any question or comments on this? So next Thursday, we have Gail Curtis going to be speaking in our class, and there he is. And he was a colleague of mine at the VA
and
for many years, and so we've been good friends. And he's going to be talking about design thinking and applied ideation, which is part of the design engineering process, and it's one of the more creative parts of the process because you get to use your mind and think wild things. So I want to let everybody know to prepare for a participatory session next on Thursday. So is there any particular skills that they should remember to bring on Thursday?
Relaxed attention.
Okay, that's good. Thank you, Gail. Right now, we're going to have a short presentation by Erica and Eric.
They're going to be talking about a project they did very recently.
And
I want you to use it as an example of what a student project can be, to what extent that they can attack a problem and come up with a unique solution.
So I'm going to turn it over to Erica and Eric.
On because it creates a lot of noise, but you can stand next to each other,
okay.
And I'll connect your
head. Okay, sure. Hello, everyone. So Eric and I. So Eric and I, we participated in a design competition this past quarter, and the theme was assistive or adaptive technologies. And so we started off with. And we went to nationals. We were finalists. Went to Washington, D.C., and we're in the top 10 out of the nation, which was pretty cool. It was fun to have that experience. And we started to, approach to find a problem and how to solve it. And I guess the first problem that we decided to attack was about people that, the elderly especially, that use walkers, and how one in every three people 65 and older tend to fall every year, and how half of those people will fall again. So we thought this is a major problem that's still happening, and deaths occur from this, and a lot of injuries occur from this.
Yeah, so and when we went into the research process, we tried to look at a specific area where falls occurred, and we found it happened mostly during transfers from the walker to something else, say like a bathtub, toilet, bed, chair. And so we kind of brainstormed a series of possible solutions, and we kind of settled on a mechanical solution. Most and the actual competition, you had to try to market a product. So a big issue was also kind of researching if insurance companies would be able to cover that, if Medicare would be able to cover the product. So that was also taken into account in our consideration. And so definitely market research is a big component, especially since a lot of medical products are very expensive. And so our approach and our design was to try to minimize cost as a solution for influence insurance companies to be willing to pay for it more.
Yeah, so like what Eric was saying, too, is marketing is a big issue, and also the part of independence for our user. Because the problem we wanted to try to attack is, let's say, we saw lots of videos of this online, too, but someone that uses a walker might be sitting in a chair on their bed, and they want to transfer themselves from the chair to the walker, and oftentimes they might rock themselves to try to push themselves up. And if you apply any sort of wrong torque on your walker, it could tip over, and that can cause, you know, injuries to hip injuries or any other muscle injury or bone or even death. And so our product will it's a mechanical arm that will will attach to a wall or any stable surface, and it can move around and attach to your walker, so it'll hold your walker still. And during moments or locations where you want to transfer in particular, like by your bed, in the bathroom, kitchen, dining room table. And so we wanted to also be able to have the user to be more independent, and so this will either allow them to have more transferring more around the house, or they won't need to stay in assisted living home, or this could even be put into assisted living residences to try to minimize costs or, you know, more hiring employees, stuff like that.
Right, and definitely something about the design process. Our original design was definitely more aggressive. We wanted to tackle almost every problem, like an arm that could be more active and help carry things and do things for a person. And would be more mobile. And so a lot of the design process for us was compromising, especially on the cost end of things. And we still probably need to iterate a few more visions. Like, I see our design, and I want to keep taking it to the next level. And so definitely testing and then revising design was a big issue in prototyping. One thing that I think our group could have done more was of rapid prototyping and trying to make the major design decisions before we got too invested in more expensive materials or more invested in our design. But I think definitely the process, our group did a good job at making those compromises and being willing to kind of take our design back to a doable level. Because especially when trying to tackle life's problems, there's really no end to what you might want to do. But what you can do in a reasonable time span is definitely very limited.
Yeah. So what we have right now, we can show you a quick demonstration. We also have a video of it, of a better video of seeing it latch onto a walker. Because we don't have the device right now that actually... the receptacle that latches onto the walker. But this is what we have. I can just carry
right.
Hold
so,
it out.
So, well, I mean, what we compromised on was more of a passive system. It'd just be a locking system. And the idea is that the arm would kind of adjust itself to the height, could be fixed at the height of the walker. And so it just, since it can only move in the horizontal plane, it... in order for the person to fall, they'd actually have to lift out of that XY plane. And so the idea is to give them like full mobility within the plane so that the arm could follow them around the room. And if they were to try to fall, it would restrain them from a moment from them rotating or from kind of going down or up. So it'd always keep the walker in the correct orientation in the plane. And so that really cut down costs for us because we compromised to make it more of a passive arm. And so we just put in a locking system. And the idea is that if there was a sudden movement, there might be a sensor in the walker, like an accelerometer, or even something that, a button that might come unhitched, like on treadmills, they have things that get pulled out, it would lock in place. And we did that with solenoids and then a circuit that kind of spiked the voltage to control those solenoids.
And this is the part that I'm holding. This is the part that attaches to a wall or stable surface. So I'm like the wall, and Eric's the walker. So we're attaching it to the walker, so you can move it around.
This is a belt buckle, which was the process that we used to attach it to walk in our prototype, but probably in a real product, it'd be more of a universal attachment, and yeah. Probably something that would be easily kind of automatically fit in. We thought about things like magnets or using other methods to kind of guide it in, just like suction the walker on.
So we can show the video real quick,
yeah,
too.
I wasn't sure how to get the...
Oh.
Yeah, you want to...
Sorry.
And I guess one of the cool things about trying to compromise and to make it a passive design is that all the elements are very cheap. So probably the circuit and all of electronics could be manufactured under $10, probably. So basically all the costs would actually be in the materials. We just cut ours out of acrylic on the laser can because it's a prototype. Our real design was supposed to use stamped metal. That's kind of a very common industrial process. It's very cost effective. And so we prototyped it using all kind of planar pieces cut on the laser cam to simulate the geometry of what stamped metal might be able to do. And so our entire design was kind of actually kept it at a reasonable price. I think it was the final, per arm, it was supposed to be like around $100, which is like extremely cheap for a piece of like medical equipment. So that's what we're really going for.
Okay. So here's our...
Audio.
Yeah. Oh, cool. These are our prototypes that we went through. That's the receiver part on the walker. So, just a preliminary idea. That's the locking system on the joints.
Lock at the same time?
I'm sorry?
All the joints lock at the same time.
So this again was like it was a prototype. So the material, like Eric said, wouldn't exactly do the job, but we were just trying to show that our arm could function as we want it to and move around. So
definitely some designing lessons to take home. I would say that if I were to redo the process again, one issue that we had was we're definitely crunched for time, and the competition wanted a lot of market research. They're very focused on costs and kind of price analysis and kind of design analysis of whether the stress would be able to hold if it were made out of the material that they're choosing. And so we didn't get to do as much work site prototyping as I preferably wanted to do. So I would say one advice in designing a medical product in general would be to actually go to places where people can actually test it and do active testing and kind of have two sets of prototypes that you'd want to recombine. And we kind of focused, you saw all our prototypes were looks like prototypes, or they're the same dimensions and kind of structural design as we wanted. But we didn't actually just go out there with a big piece of steel rod and actually try to mock that up because of time constraints and cost constraints. But in general, I'd say definitely have at least two sets of prototypes and go out and definitely do the works-like prototyping to make sure the concept itself works, and then combine them at the very end.
How long did you work on the project?
The project we started in the summer, but you have to basically the first stage of the competition, you have to write the full proposal with all the market research and turn that in, and then they invite the winning teams to prototype it and then fly out to DC. And so the first stage we started over the summer, and then the second stage was probably a month in the fall quarter.
Okay. A month and a half.
Maybe
a
month and a half of construction.
And about a month of ideation.
I think it's important to recognize that you went through a lot of prototypes before you got to the one that you really liked.
And yes,
I think that's another message to take for the people that are working on projects, to consider multiple prototypes. Okay. Well, thank you very much for bringing
that and
being with us today. Thanks. Okay, before we go any further, I want to pass out the sign-up sheets. Remember, the pink one is for students, and the white one is for community members. And if you've already signed up or you already get an email announcement, then you don't have to sign the white one again. So at this time, I'd like to introduce our main speaker, Deb.
Can I do the video first?
It didn't work.
Did not work.
Okay. I have one still. The first frame is there.
It didn't play.
All right. So Debbie has been an OT for the last 16 years, splitting her time between Stanford and the VA R&D Center where I worked, where she collaborated on numerous design, development, research projects with engineers and students. Her work has included testing and integrating technology into the rehab setting with individuals with Parkinson's, stroke, spinal cord injury, hand therapy, and balance problems related to aging. She currently works with post-stroke survivors at REACH and coordinates a research project in Stanford Medical School's Department of Hand Surgery, and is also a frequent guest lecturer with the Multiple Sclerosis Society of Santa Clara, and she's an annual presenter in my class. So let's welcome Debbie Kenny.
I'm like Eric Stableman. I like to point with my fingers. I find it a little bit easier, and I like to move around. And I want to give you an opportunity right now. If anybody needs to stretch before I start my talk, please feel free, and feel free to ask questions during the talk. I also have more equipment that I brought to share, some things that OTs tend to use and that are kind of along the line of keep it simple. And that's what I always try to do when I work with any of the teams from this engineering course, is I try to keep it simple. I try to get you to have a good understanding of the disability that you're working with. And that's all a part about being an occupational therapist. And we mentioned last time that it's a healthcare profession that focuses on helping people of all ages to develop mastery of everyday skills. We call those ADLs or IADLs, in order to live independently productive and satisfying lives. So we try to go for independence and increase through functional activities. This is a little bit different than a physical therapist. A physical therapist would tend to use exercise regimes only. We tend to find what someone is interested in, what motivates them, and utilize that activity to get our desired effect. For instance, I was hit by a car, and I've got a shoulder tear, and I needed to do a lot of exercise. Now, I could have sat there with a piece of TheraBand, and I could have done this for hours on end, strengthening up my muscles that I needed to make sure my shoulder was back. But I had young kids at the time, and it was much more satisfying to push them on a swing. So that's an example of using a functional activity to do a task and using the same muscle. Now, as I said, which would you rather do? push a kid on a swing or do that. It's up to an individual. There's no one right way or wrong way. And that's, again, about what occupational therapists do. They look at the whole person. We don't just look at one person and say, you're a person, you have this disease, this defines who you are. Everybody's an individual first, and we need to treat the whole person, both psychologically and physically. Occupational therapy practitioners work in a lot of different areas. You might see them in hospital and acute care settings, working in orthopedics, in inpatient rehab, working with people who've had spinal cord injuries or strokes, specialty units, nursing homes, to try to get people again to be out of the nursing home and to be as independent as possible, to be able to get home. They work in home health. Once people are at home, there's still a need for rehabilitation and being able to be as independent as you can with your ADLs and work rehabilitation. We work both in the work site and in work hardening clinics. Ergonomics is an area that's oftentimes done by an occupational therapist. We have a good understanding of what we call kinesiology, the body in motion, studying the body in motion. What muscle do you need to do this activity? If you're working and you want to drink this bottle of water and you need to hold this bottle, what kind of muscle force do you need? What muscles are you using? Could we adapt that if we can't get the muscles? How can you work smarter? How can you use energy conservation in terms of how you're doing machining or anything else that you're doing in your daily life so you're expending less energy and you have more energy for the things that you want? It's about balance. It's about balance of work, play, and self-care. They also work in the psychiatric mental health settings and helping people to come to terms with dementia. We work with people with TBI, with memory. So lots of different areas. We work in with the pediatric setting in schools. And again, there's specialty areas. I worked in hand therapy for quite a few years. And there's driver rehabilitation. It doesn't have to be done by an OT, but OTs are in this area. Again, low vision rehabilitation. There's a center over at EA. I don't know. Are you going to visit that, Dave?
Yes, we're going to go over to spinal cord.
Okay, but there's also a low vision center at the VA in case anybody's interested in that, and there's expertise in that there, and they do have occupational therapists working in that environment, again, to work to get people as independent as possible. Wheelchair seating. How many of you guys have worked with an occupational therapist to get the best kind of seating so that you are as comfortable as possible? And that is a real specialty area. I won't even pretend to know a whole heck of a lot about it. I do seating with people who've had strokes, but seating with people who have cerebral palsy or some spasticity issues, spinal cord injury, really involves a level of expertise that's much higher than your general occupational therapist. Again, we work in the area of assistive technology. We're really good at taking something that's in the environment and being able to adapt that as we adapt the activity. And we work in design, accessibility, and consultation. How can you take your house and make it as safe and independent for you as a person who has a problem as possible? Okay. All right, thanks. Any questions about what an OT does? I want to tell you a little bit more about myself while he's changing the slide. I also have my bachelor's degree in kinesiology from UCLA. And that's the study, again, of the body in motion. I specialize in biomechanics, so I understand the gait cycle really well, which is very unusual for most occupational therapists. But it really helped me out in my profession. And the reason that I chose OT over PT is that I'm kind of a creative person, and this really spoke to me as a profession. And I stayed in research. I've been in research, medical research, since high school. And I've done everything from publish in analytic chemistry to publishing in occupational therapy and working with robotics and working with falls in the elderly, a lot of different areas. So I have a very wide background. And hopefully you can utilize that expertise when you have questions about any of the projects that you're thinking about working on. So, the big question is, you guys come at it from an engineering standpoint. You're going to develop something. right? But once a product is developed, how does it actually get to the consumer? There's a lot of different ways that we can talk about it. And again, we should really define, Dave, did you already do this, really have a good definition of assistive technology?
I had my own definition.
Okay. So lots of different definitions. This comes from a very occupational therapy perspective. So a tool that maximizes your independence and activities of daily living. So in your case, being able to get up and stand in your walker and be able to utilize that walker without tipping over backwards, that's pretty important. So it will allow an individual to discharge to the home if they're in a hospital setting, to be able to return to that independence or to prevent further decline. We also actually work with healthy people to try to prevent them from the disease process from overwhelming them. Again, that balance of work plan self-care. And here we have a mobility device. Now, I don't oftentimes recommend a scooter, but for certain people that have problems with their energy levels and locomotion, this might be a good way of being able to make sure that they can get out into the community. Self-care. This person here is putting on the sock. I think Tanner, was it? The prosthetist?
Mike Norrell.
Mike Norrell talked about being able to put on compression stockings. And here, even just putting on a sock, if you can't bend forward, how are you going to put on a sock? Well, there's ways out there. I'll show you a couple of these little guys. And they're not the end-all, be-all. You know, when I work with... You'll see a bunch of my students in here. Some of them have use of both hands, and some of them have use of only one hand. Some of them have the flexibility to be able to get their foot up and wouldn't need a device like this. But if they needed a device like this, this would be pretty impossible to utilize, because trying to get a sock on this with one hand, even if you can push it out there and put your foot in it, is pretty difficult. So you guys can pass these around. Do you want to see that? And you can play around with them, and I'll have more. Communication's a big area. Occupational therapists don't, of course, do communication, but it's a part of assistive technology and that return to independence. Some of my students today, you'll notice, have some difficulty with their speech, and that's because of the stroke. And there's aphasia, which means difficulty finding the word, sometimes difficulty understanding the word. There's also the word dysarthria, which means difficulty forming the words motorically. So there's a lot of different areas of communication and different ways to handle it. And it doesn't mean that everybody who has aphasia is going to want to use a communication device. It's really up to the individual and how they view themselves. And, of course, there's leisure. Anybody ever see one of these? They have one in Santa Cruz. Where'd you see it?
Hawaii.
You guys all know what this is? This has got really, really huge wheels so it can go over the sand. And it can transport a person who is in a wheelchair along the beach and into the water. I have a friend with a spinal cord injury who scuba dives. He can use his arms really well, and he enjoys scuba diving. It gives him a lot of sense of freedom being in the water and floating and being able to really move around in his environment. But you need to be able to get a person down to the beach. So something like this. And I've seen them made with PVC. Quite clever. And, of course, we want to also make sure that people who want to work. This gentleman is welding, and he's in a wheelchair that's helping him to stand up to be able to do that. Prescribing rehabilitation equipment. We go from you have to get a prescription from the doctor for big pieces of durable medical equipment. Something simple like a built-up pen, of course, you're not going to need a prescription for. But something like a wheelchair or a walker, you are. And so what is this process here that allows the equipment to go from the doctor to the end user? First, we need to talk about the team, the transdisciplinary team. We got a huge team of people that work in the field of rehabilitation to make sure that people get the correct equipment. I won't go over all of these. Do people know the term physiatrist? No. Physiatrist is a doctor who works in the field of rehabilitation. And please do stop me anytime I use a catch-all phrase that may be part of my profession that I'm comfortable with that you might not know. So physiatrists are your rehabilitation doctor. And we've got engineers. If you bring a medical device into a hospital setting, you may have to make sure that it's not going to, you know, mess around with the EKG machines and other things that are going on. There needs to be certain shielding. There's certain requirements that happen. Of course, a family, the caregivers are a big part, whether they're going to accept the equipment or not accept the equipment. There's speech and language pathologists, there's social workers, there's the prosthetist, very important for a lot of medical devices. There's medical consultants, there's the equipment vendors, who may or may not be the best choice of somebody to decide what equipment somebody gets. Physical therapists, nurse practitioners, lots of different people. So it's a team. But remember, the most important part of the team is the patient or the person that we're working with who needs the equipment. And this is my, it's used to say device discontinuance, but I really wanted to talk about device continuance. What equipment, and how do we decide as a therapist that a piece of equipment is suitable for somebody? We go through a long and involved thought process. We can make it look really easy. Aha, get Mr. X, this piece of equipment. But it's not that easy. There's a lot of different factors to consider when we're doing this. This is an example. We talk about the devices. How easy or difficult is the device? Is it easy for somebody to use? Can they use it on their own? Does it really make sense? One of my favorite devices, and I didn't get to bring it because my kids hit it, is a reacher. So what I use actually in the kitchen, because I don't always have a reacher because the kids are always screwing around with it, and they use it, and it's one of those pieces of equipment I think it's everybody should have, whether they have a problem with moving or not, is a reacher, because you can reach down low, you can reach up high, and so I use my major tongs, my big barbecuing tongs. I use them all the time in the kitchen. I'm 4'10". So reaching up, and my husband's a foot taller than I am. So you can imagine where things end up and the fact that I utilize this a lot to get things down off of shelves. This is an easy solution to the problem. I can make it a little harder, right? There's all kinds of things that I can do to get those boxes up on the shelf, but why make it difficult when I can make it easy? So we really have a continuum when we talk about assistive technology and what kind of assistive technology that we're giving to people, from very, very simple. This is an example of mechanics of writing and what you might do for that. So you go from a pencil, which is very low-tech. Everybody knows how to use it. You've been trained how to use it in the schools. I don't need to provide you with training. But you start to get into things where kids who have trouble writing might use a slant board to provide them with proprioceptive feedback. That's feedback on knowing where their limbs are in space. And no longer a typewriter, but now a computer. I have a child with a learning disability. He uses his computer, finds it easier, uses drag and dictate when he needs to. Starts to get, a little bit more difficult. Requires some training.
What's drag and dictate again?
Drag and dictate, or drag and naturally speaking, it is a program. Huh?
You talk
and it types for you. And for my child especially, until he learned to type fast enough, this was a really good way for him to be able to get his thoughts down on paper. Now, it makes some really funny, you know, errors in terms of spelling and the words, and you go, what? But it's funny, and you can connect up to the web, and you can do all kinds of different things for it. But when you start to get to that level of technology, you start to get to the point where you need to provide training to people. You can't just say, oh, here, here's your dragon dictate, you know, just go ahead and use it. You'll be fine. You'll be good. And, you know, then it ends up sitting on the shelf and nobody utilizes it. So a continuum here, and you have to be careful how you approach the continuum with any assistive device. This person's typing with their toes. And we're going to go look again, and we're going to say, we're going to look now in terms of this next big red box and about who pays. We better take that into our minds when we're thinking about what kind of a piece of adaptive equipment. And you guys were challenged, I think, by this, because we can't have pieces of equipment that are out there unless we get buy-in from the insurance companies and buy-in from Medicare that will allow us to utilize them. Otherwise, they need to be cheap, because typically smaller pieces of equipment need to be bought by the families or by the person who's using it themselves. That's not necessarily easy, and I think you've probably faced this amount of frustration where there's something out there that looks really, really good, is really, really tempting. It's like this little app, you know, this little apple out there. It's like, ooh, and it's like, I can't afford that, but it would be really cool if I had it. You guys know the difference between Medicare and Medicaid? Medicaid is for poor people. You don't have to be of any certain age to get that. It's called Medi-Cal within the state of California. Medicare is for people who are older. VA has its own insurance system. I loved working at the VA as an occupational therapist. They didn't put a lot of restrictions on what kind of equipment that I ordered for people. If I can make a point that person was going to be better off and more independent, I was able to do that. You can't do that with private insurance. Private insurance says one piece of durable medical equipment, maybe two, possibly three, and you got to keep it for a long, long time. And I don't know, do you rent? You bought, you know, so, but you had to pay something in order to do that. They pay part of it, you pay part of it. Even a regular wheelchair, a manual wheelchair, could have to be rented. Now, it's not a lot. You think, oh, $6 a month or $10 a month, big deal for 13 months. But then you can't get another wheelchair for 3 years. So what happens if your wheelchair breaks down, especially with power devices? They have a tendency of doing that. You need to have a backup system. So you have to be careful about who's going to pay for this. Can you actually, you know, if you say, I really want you to have this device, can the person pay for that? Can they actually get the equipment that they need? Then we look into a lot of different factors here. Culture is very important. There are certain cultures where caregiving is part of the norm. That if I went to an elderly Filipino man and I told him, my goal for you in getting out of the hospital is that you should be able to dress yourself, and the family would go, well, why? I'm you know, going to do the dressing for mom or dad, because that's a part, you know, of that culture. So you have to be careful about not, and this is important in your design process too, don't put your own prejudice forward. You need to listen to the people and listen to where they're coming from. What kind of support system do they have if you have a power device? Do you have a support system for when it breaks down? And what kind of motivation do you have for being independent? What kind of motivation do you have for using an adaptive device? We talked again last week about prosthetics and the fact that some people who are born without a limb may choose not to get a prosthesis. And that's because of how they see themselves, the perception of themselves. They see themselves as whole. They see themselves as able. Age plays a factor in what kind of devices you give to people. If you're giving somebody who's never used a computer before, a computer-driven device, and they're over the age of 80, and you haven't gotten a lot of training, you're going to have a very bad problem where you're not going to utilize the device, and then you failed as a therapist in issuing device. Gender. Sometimes men are more willing to accept certain devices, and women are other devices. What level of education do people have plays a role in whether they will accept the device or not? What's your health status? Is this a chronic problem that you're dealing with. This is a changing problem where you're going to need to make adaptations to the device as you go along. Is this an acute problem? What's the diagnosis? Understanding the diagnosis is incredibly, incredibly important in the design process. If you don't understand this, then when you're designing, you may be designing for the wrong problem. A case and example, Dave, is that I've been working with the team for the Centers for Excellence, and they're working with the weavers of India in rural India. And they were told that they needed to make these looms better for these women. It was traditionally a male job. And these men are now out working in farms in different areas. So the women have taken over these pit looms in these rural villages, and they're not able to work very long. And the students that I was working with had one idea of what that project was like, and I was kind of skeptical about it. But we worked on this, and we developed a prototype, and we sent it to India. And they said, oh, thank you very much. That was a very nice prototype. We really liked it. Very colorful, very nice, except that's not the problem at all. Yeah, they thought the problem was somebody's back and how they were sitting. And in fact, that these women have actually perfect postures, and the problem was they couldn't move the heddles, the big things to make the weaving go, and they had to be able to do that, and how do we do that? So it became a totally different problem. So it's really important to understand what it is that you're actually trying to build for. And again, it's not a one-size-fits-all. Factors about if they rent versus you own your own equipment. If you look at the physical environment, are there stairs in their house? What does that mean to somebody? If you're in a rural setting, maybe you can make a long ramp. But maybe if you're in a city, you can't make a ramp into somebody's house. And so how do you adapt to that? So a lot of different questions that we go through our mind. We try to go to people's homes, if at all possible, to do an evaluation, to be able to say, yes, this is the right piece of equipment for that person's home. And here's an example of problems that we do sometimes see. An example of this is people who've been issued a long-handled sponge during their hospital stay. And the reason that they're issued the long-handled sponge is because they can't reach down to wash their lower legs and their feet. And so out of 100 devices that were issued, only 70% ended up being used. But if you look at the follow-up at 12 months, that still using the device is now only at 50%. And there's a lot of reasons why. Sometimes we gave people devices that didn't need devices. Sometimes, again, they had other help. And so that was an acceptable solution to the problem. Didn't work. Well, why didn't it work? Did we test it out beforehand? Did we provide enough training? It's unclear from this particular article as to why there's this problem. But you see this time and time again with adaptive equipment in the community where we're issuing adaptive equipment and it's not being what we want it to. And hopefully when we talk to some of my students from my class, and if you guys would like to also pitch in with the discussion, we can talk a little bit more about that area. So we got to select the device for the activity. How are we going to instruct the people? Instruction is really, really important. When are we going to introduce the device? Are we going to introduce it in the hospital? Or are we going to introduce it when they come home? We need to reinforce its use. And, of course, we've got to try to get the insurance companies, if at all possible, to pay for this device. Training ensures success. And I can't say this enough. And this is why it's really important that a therapist or somebody on the rehab team be involved when something is a little bit more complicated than a pen with a pencil grip. Because it's only with the repetition, it's only with the training that the use of the device actually makes sense and people can utilize it the way it needs to be utilized. For instance, your device, I could see, would need quite a bit of training to utilize it and figure out, you know, how people could use this the best. And there's a lot of different ways, of course, of providing that training. Hands-on is best, but we don't always have the resources to do a lot of hands-on training. And frankly, when people go home from the hospital, they tend to forget. And unfortunately, insurances don't necessarily pay for the home health people to come by and provide training in the home so that you can remember. If you ever end up, and it could be an orthopedic injury or anything, where you end up needing rehabilitation services, there's a lot thrown at you in the hospital, and there's a lot to remember. And it tends to be overwhelming for families. It tends to be overwhelming for the patients. And trying to remember, even if we give you a written piece of paper to send you home with, it's a lot. Reinforcement, again, the transition to the community, follow-up, support groups. For the Peninsula Stroke Association, a lot of my students take part in Peninsula Stroke Association. Talks again about what equipment's out there, what works, what doesn't work. And again, refresher training might be necessary. Again, unfortunately, not everybody who needs equipment and rehabilitation services gets it. There is, again, a study that was done that said 30% of the people who needed to get a piece of adaptive equipment couldn't get it. And that goes for therapy, too. And I think you would probably, all of my students, and one of the reasons that it's really neat that I can do this at a community college is to teach as an occupational therapist and provide that, is that there isn't a lot of follow-up. Typically, for somebody who's had an acute stroke, you get 2 weeks in hospital treatment. You're supposed to learn in 2 weeks. Now that you've got a sign that's not working, you're supposed to learn everything that you need to do in 2 weeks to go home. And then, if you're lucky, maybe you get a couple of weeks of in-home health care, you know, from an OT and a PT to kind of get you set up and make sure your equipment's there. And then they kind of leave you as is. And what do you do? I know for myself, it's hard for me to even want to exercise, you know, without some motivation from outside. So support groups play a big role, and being able to be in an environment like the REACH program at Foothill is pretty neat. Bunch of other resources. We don't really need to go over this, but you can check this out. It will be on the posted slides. This is a really cool site, though. If you want to learn about adaptive equipment that are out there and you have a question if it exists or doesn't exist, even if it's not currently on the market, this abledata.com is a really terrific website to go to. North Coast Medical is a local medical company that issues equipment, and same thing with Smith Nephew. That's the end of my slideshow, but I've got a bunch of different devices to show, and we'll kind of do that as we talk to my students. So if my students from the REACH program would come on down, and I want to be able to have them answer some questions about their use of adaptive devices. And anybody else who would like to come up to the front and talk. So Albert, come on down. Alan, come on down. Michael, Kevin, come on down. Oh, my other favorite piece of equipment, and all my students will tell you about that, and it's one that I have in my kitchen, and I think everybody, again, should have, and I try to use it on every single piece of engineering project that I've ever done, and I'm usually pretty successful at that. This is called Dyson. And Dyson, D-Y-C-E-M, my favorite stuff. I use it for myself to open jars and to open bottles. But it's really great to put under surfaces like plates to keep them from sliding if you're using just one hand. And you are going to, let me get this down so you can see. If you're going to do something like scoop ice cream, think about it. If you had this thing here and you're scooping ice cream, what would happen? It would move all over the place. As soon as I put it on here, it's not going anywhere. This stuff is terrific. And it comes in a lot of different forms. It's defective. Is this not your...
Effective.
It's effective. Okay. Is it your favorite stuff?
Yeah, I have...
And it comes in sheets like this. This is a little less sticky. So where do you pick this up? Yeah, this is a easily available variation. This is a shelf liner. It's almost as good as Dysom, not quite as good. Dysom you can get from Northcombs Medical or any of the other. You're going to be a little bit surprised at how expensive it is. Students, I do have extra material, so ask me. I mean, really, it's truly, truly, truly my favorite stuff. And it just helps to hold on to a lot of different devices. And I don't know. We use it in the classroom a lot for what?
Keeping papers from slipping around.
Can you guys hear?
Keeping papers from slipping around.
Yeah. So Alan is writing with one hand. Again, you get the problem of that the paper wants to slide around if you don't have the other hand up. I like him to get his arm up, and he can't. But it's not an all-the-time thing. How about you? Do you use Dysom for anything?
Yeah, quite a bit. At home, I use it. When I eat, I put my things on. Instead of placemat, I use the Dysom to keep everything in place, to put my hands and to keep it in place so that the blood flow wouldn't go over to my hand and swell up. So these are little things that you may not be thinking of, but these are very important things for us.
I'd use it when I eat. I put the plate to one slide on the line for dinner.
Yeah, and you have both hands. Do you use it ever to open jars?
I use the other device, the plastic.
Yeah, that's like that. Mm-hmm. How about you?
You do SSR with a weight bearing.
It's weight bearing. So he's talking about weight bearing, and we use weight bearing for people who've had a stroke. As you can see, some of their arms are tight, and we call this a synergy pattern. This is a flexor synergy pattern. It has to do a little bit with gravity and the neurological system not being quite right. There's ways of getting out of that so that we can get the arms where we need to. You might be able to have the arms move around so you can get dressed correctly. And so one of the ways we do this is we weight bear. You know, have somebody really push down and put a lot of weight over onto that side, or even onto their arm, and that can affect then turn that bicep off. And that's typically the biggest problem is the bicep being on. Yeah. So weight bearing, that's good. What other piece of adaptive equipment do you guys use and like to use? I see. Are we looking at shoes, guys?
Yeah. I found this Salomon shoes. It has a quick lace. In the beginning, when I had my stroke, my therapist asked me to tie my shoelace. Fortunately, I was ambidextrous, and I could do it with one hand. So I was impressed. So for a long time, I was wearing a boot, and I was able to tie my shoes, a shoelace. But I found this really nice thing. It's a quick lace. Most probably some of you know easy.
Yeah,
and it's already undone.
Yep. See? And Alan here, you use what?
Velcro.
And there's a lot of different ones out there.
We'd be in bad shape if somebody hadn't invented Velcro.
That's my other favorite. And it used to be when I used to make splints for people, we didn't have Velcro way back when I first started in the profession, and we had to, like, put grommets in things and tie things up. And it was really quite the process to make a splint and keep a splint on.
See when I got at the beginning, they gave me elastic ties. When I used to put my shoes, I used to slide in. Plus, I'm using horn to put my shoes in.
Right. So elastic. There's a kind of a fun elastic shoelace. You're using Velcro. So this is a fun elastic shoelace that kids use out in the community. So it's interesting that some of the products that have started out in the rehab community are making their way out into the regular community. So what you do is just twist it, and now it's tied.
It stays in place, so you don't have to tie a knot.
kids think those coilers are cool.
They do. They do. They're a lot of fun.
Quite a low tech, but it's amazing. It's stupid things.
And for some of my students, it's difficult. Some of them have splints that they wear, AFOs, and they require different size shoes. Thank goodness for Nordstrom's. Yeah, do you see you have two different size shoes?
No,
you were able to accommodate?
I like to wear sneakers because you normally buy one size larger. So I have what they call an SMO. It's a very small piece of equipment that you can just insert, almost like an insert.
Yeah, for you, it's mostly lateral stability. Yeah. For a lot of other people, when they're walking after a stroke, it's that they can't pull up their toe. And so if you can't pull up your toe and your toe's down here and you're walking, what
exactly.
Do you think happens? It, like, kind of drags along. And so you don't want that. So we put on, can we see, who's got an ankle foot orthosis on? Woo, legs!
I have this almost for 8 years. I changed it 4 different times. At the beginning, they gave me 2 pieces. Then after 6 months, they gave me another with 1 piece. Then after another year, they gave me one with 1 piece again. Then they gave me another with hinges.
This is hinge, so he can actually use some toe to help do propulsion through the walk.
Then they gave me another hinge because everyone is keep breaking up, getting loose, getting bad. So
and Albert actually walks, so he does walk, but it takes a lot of energy for Albert to walk. And when I was showing you the project with the cycling, one of the things that's difficult is that the speed at which a lot of my students walk is pretty slow. They're not going to get into aerobic capacity. Cycling is one way that they can do it, but as I said, it takes somebody else to set them up to be able to do that. How about you? Any favorite pieces of equipment or things that work for you or don't work for you?
I tried the stabilet, my arm, but it didn't work for me.
Okay.
I tried to be hard to move our assembly together because it's not complicated to assemble
yeah.
together.
And a lot of my students, what they would really like, and I didn't propose this to the class because I think it's a very difficult problem, is that one of the things that happens with stroke is you get this reduction of energy that I talked about, and it happens into the fingers too. So they can grab and they can hold onto an object. The problem is.
I can hold it.
But you can't let it go.
Exactly. When
you can't let it go. And the more you try, the harder it becomes. Now, if you relax, he's really relaxed, I can get his fingers stretched out. Be nice. But it becomes a real problem. And for a lot of my students, they would really like to be able to have that bilateral capacity to be able to, as I said, not only hold the objects and stabilize the object in kind of a gross grip, but to be able to let it go. And the devices that are out there that you use, did you use the Savo Flex?
No.
Oh, you did.
I'm still going to, on Thursday, I'm going to go use the
okay.
There's three sensors and this big put your leg and the wood. There's a lot of electronics. There's motor and the electronics. So because I can't move my leg, the motor make my leg move better. Plus, when I walk, my toe keep curling inside if I don't use the brace. So that device is helping me to walk a little bit better.
Right.
Yes, so.
Yeah.
Maybe you can describe to them, since you're an engineer, the mechanics or the electronics of it, even in simple terms, because it's difficult to understand.
Okay, there is a leg like a boot, and there's hinges on side. Also, there's a lot of electronics. Also, in the bottom, there's two sensors. If you don't put your leg, the sensor doesn't work. So you have to put your leg down, because I always work on my toes. That's the bad thing.
Yeah, and he tends not to weight bear, and this is very typical, is that you don't weight bear enough on your affected leg. So it's really interesting, a gait. So if you look, that when you're bringing forward your unaffected leg, you actually see it go really fast because nobody trusts their affected side. And so that's an interesting issue.
I'm sorry. Because in the stroke patient, you will hear the term drop foot.
Exactly.
Which means that you can't control your foot and ankle and bend them.
Yeah.
It's 5:30, so anybody who has to leave can leave now, but we're going to be doing
this. We're willing to stick with us if you want to. And there's stuff on the back table. Before you go, though, anybody know? Anybody know? The rocker knife. Well, you know the rocker knife. You've seen it. This is our fourth time seeing it. Yeah? Yeah? Rocker knife. Again, if you don't have two hands well to cut with, you need to be able to stabilize your food. You rock it. A very easy, simple, mechanical solution to a very difficult problem. What's another solution? What other solution could people use to cut up their food? Electric knife?
Mm-hmm.
What else? Come on, guys. Think. I like it. you could have somebody else cut it up for you, right? You know, they'll do that for you so that you don't have to be embarrassed in the back of the restaurants.
I've gone to a restaurant where somebody else that had a stroke, and this individual asked if the chef would cut the meat up for him.
So you don't necessarily have to. I don't know. Did any of you, were any of you issued a rocker knife at all when you were discharged?
No. I bought one, but also I bought a device. It's like a vice grip that allows me to put something in it and hold it. It's very easy. One arm or hand, yeah. So you need something. Some of us are not. Good side is still functional, so that helps. But single-handedly trying to open a jaw, for example, or slicing a bread, or even putting butter on your bread, sliced bread, is a challenge. You don't normally go home with these types of devices to help you.
Right.
So.
VA does allow you to go home with these devices, which shows you, again, the big difference between the VA system and private insurance in terms of what they do issue and what they don't issue. Other things that are kind of cool, this will help you to hold on to an item. Again, Velcro's wonderful stuff. Goes with the hand, it's a hand mitt. So if you want a hand cycle, you could utilize that. This can have different devices that you can put in it. A lot of my guys here actually have some shoulder movement. The problem is, again, the grip, and how do you utilize that and use the hand? The more times you use the hand, the better the brain gets the signal that you need it to do the right thing. Questions? You guys can ask questions of these guys. That's fine. That's okay.
Salomon? Yeah. They have that, what they call the quick release.
Yeah.
I've seen the device too in some gold shoes where they have something that you, like a screw on behind to tighten the shoelace. But that's not quite readily available on regular shoes, though.
It's like a way of shoe re-engineering.
Yeah.
I have a comment about the Dyson. I too also use Dyson at home when I eat oatmeal for breakfast. I have an assistant put the bowl on there for me so that I can eat it by myself.
So use
rolls of Dyson.
Yeah.
Like you said, it's all, someone said it's all over the house.
Yeah. I have it all over. I have it in my bathroom, and I have it in my kitchen.
The Wii.
The Wii. I brought the Wii into class, and it's pretty fun because I can put it like on somebody's wrist where they're not having to hold it, and we can work more on shoulder and we can work on elbow. The problem is that sometimes when you get so involved in an activity like that, and you're like really trying really hard, it all of a sudden increases what's their synergy.
It's very good for entertainment because when you've been in our condition for 15 years, like in my case, there are a lot of things that you couldn't, you haven't been able to do for many years, and you would like to be able to participate in, do something physical.
That brings up a thought. I think when David talked about diagnosis, it's important if you talk to patients to find out what they're interested in. Because it is in their, whatever they're interested in, they're well motivated. An example to that is I love photography. I used to do photography in high school. All of a sudden, I'm affected on my right side. Guess what? All DSLR cameras are right-handed. So it took me about 6 months to figure out simple device to help me. What I did was I went through all kinds of customers. I work with engineers, so I have this mind, analytical mind. What I ended up with was a gorilla tripod where you could flex it. And then I wear it on my chest. I mount it in the camera so it can act as support, so I can adjust the camera and eventually press the shutter.
There's all
that
kinds of equipment.
There's
all kinds of equipment out there. There's equipment out there for hunting and fishing from your wheelchair that'll help you cast the fishing pole and bring it in. It's just a matter of what, Gail? Money.
I just want to finish my thought on the. The diagnosis, the interest in the diagnosis, because with this device I was able, because it was an interest, it was a passion, it allowed me to go out the door every day to do my walks. Without it, I would stay home and watch the television. So that spurred me out there. So that was my point.
Perhaps this is a good time to sort of break up and have people come down and look at some of the other devices, as well as Eric and Erica's stuff, and there's some stuff back, so...
There's stuff all over.
Yeah, there's lots of things.
Lots of little things all over.